Court of the State of Nevada is now in session. The Honorable Justice Douglas presiding.
Please be seated. We're back on the record in the Webb versus Celebrate Properties, case number 55153. If the parties are ready to proceed, please do so. Please state your name, and if you wish to reserve any time, please let us know how much.
Reserve 3 minutes, Your Honor. My name is Roberto Cisneros, representing Scott Levin.
I'm not sure if you want to introduce yourself. I'm Edward Coleman, representing the appellee in Cross Appellate.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Justice Douglas, Justice Paragiri, Justice Hardesty. May it please the Court. As I mentioned, my name is Norberto Cisneros, and I represent the plaintiff, Scott Webb, in this matter. Mr. Webb, as you've probably read, we've put a lot of the information in our briefs. He's an individual who was duped into purchasing a residence with significant defects. Specifically, we're looking at the soils defects that existed at the residence and not disclosed by the defendants in this matter. With Harry Scholl in particular, an individual representing as an agent for the company, Celebrate Properties. Mr. Scholl signed all of the documents, and as you know from the record already, signed it not disclaiming and not disclosing, I apologize, the defects within the residence. Real quickly, let me start by giving a quick overview of how the record was developed in this case. Because of the fact that my client does not have significant resources, came to me and said, I'd like to bring this case. I said, well, there's a lot of issues along that could be problematic with it. As I guessed, it went all the way to trial and did go to trial. Neither party elected to have the transcript transcribed because of the fact that the costs involved. That truly was the only issue. However, let me clarify what was in the record. There was significant pleadings. There was discovery that was conducted. There were motions that were brought. There were also exhibits presented at trial, and there were experts. Several experts, two experts on behalf of plaintiff, and experts, I believe one expert on behalf of the defendant. And this was a judge trial, again, mostly for economic reasons. However, to clarify or state that the record is incomplete or anything of that nature, that the trial court didn't have the information it needed to make a proper and sound decision would absolutely be an erroneous characterization. There was substantial and significant amounts of information before that trial court when she made her decision and issued her findings of facts and conclusions of law. In relation to the standard of this case, I look to Polaris, Industrial Corp., and Kaplan. And the first issue I'm going to address, Your Honors, there's two issues in this case I think you've read from the pleadings. Number one is we obviously believe the court made an erroneous decision when she decided that we could not pierce Celebrate Properties' corporate veil and seek relief from Mr. Harry Scholl, the defendant in this case. We have characterized that in our brief and characterized that as our main issue on appeal. There was a counter appeal, which has to do with whether or not she properly issued treble damages against in favor of my client for the failure to disclose under Section 113. There seems to be a disagreement as to whether what the standard should be and whether there was a necessity to prove wanton and malicious type of activity to entitle us to the treble damages. Those are the two issues as I see it. So let me address first the issue that affects us and the issue that we took, and that is whether or not the district court judge made an erroneous decision by not allowing us to pierce the corporate veil. In the case of Polaris Industrial Corp. versus Kaplan, 103 Nevada 598, this very court stated the general rule is that where the evidence is conflicting and there is substantial evidence to support the judgment, it will not be disturbed. But there is an exception when it is clear that a wrong conclusion has been reached. And your task is, on appeal, is to determine whether the trial court's finding in this case mandated a contrary conclusion. I believe that the findings of fact and conclusions of law, the evidence that's before you that we've submitted on appeal, the exhibits that were presented to the court, the district court, that you will see clearly there was an erroneous decision in this matter.
Well, let's start with the findings of fact.
Yes, Your Honor.
Under Borgerson versus Scanlon, when the transcript isn't provided to us, we're required to assume that the record supports the lower court's findings. Where in the findings of fact, prepared by your office, I guess, did the court commit error in its connection of the findings to its conclusion that the alter ego theory should not be found?
Well, and I want to address that, Your Honor, because I think that holding has to do with a judgment, when there's a judgment and no transcript.
Well, could you answer my question?
Yes, Your Honor.
Where in the findings of fact did the court commit error in making the conclusion of law it reached that the alter ego theory would not be permitted?
Well, I believe the facts that we've outlined, and in particular addressing the statute, Nevada Rice Statute 78.747, I do not believe she applied the facts to that statute and came up with the appropriate decision.
Well, can you point to a specific finding of fact made by the judge that shows that she should have arrived at a contrary conclusion under the alter ego statute?
Yes, Your Honor, and I will do that right now. As I'm pulling out the findings of fact and conclusions of law.
Mm-hmm. I have those in front of me as well.
But let me start with the way that the actual negotiations went down. Because as we know, the first thing we need to show is that a corporation is influenced and governed by the stockholder, director, or officer. In this case, Your Honors, Mr. Scholl, which we established and is in the findings of fact and conclusions of law, negotiated everything on behalf, in this transaction, on behalf of Celebrate Properties. He clearly was acting as their only agent. In that regard, he was influencing and governing Celebrate Properties. That's the first fact that we look to.
Well, in the findings of fact number 2, it says Mr. Scholl, through his corporation, Best Communities, Inc., was a managing member, which leads one to believe there were more than one in that corporation.
That's correct. There was one other, Your Honor. And the other managing partner, actually, we found no evidence that he participated in the transaction or actually in the management of the company at all. All the transactions appear to come through.
But that's not in the findings of fact.
That's correct, Your Honor.
What you just said is not in the findings of fact. It might lead one to arrive at a different conclusion, but it's not in the findings of fact.
That is correct. So we put in the findings of fact.
So in the findings of fact, you ask us to read into this finding that Scholl settled the construction defect case, but as the managing member of the corporation, that would have been his responsibility.
I don't disagree.
So where in these findings are we supposed to find that he was acting outside of his role as the managing member of the company?
Okay. I think most...
Because that's what the statutes and our case law dealing with piercing addresses.
Right. And I agree, Your Honor. The strongest evidence we presented showing how he was acting outside of the corporate system that had been set up for Celebrate Properties was when he purchased the property back after this Chapter 40 notice. He purchased it in his own name. It was purchased, and this is in the findings of fact, conclusions of law, just in his name, Harry Scholl. He did that because Celebrate Properties could not get financed for that transaction. Again, in the findings of fact, conclusions of law. He did that shows, number one, that Celebrate Properties clearly didn't have the capitalization it needed, wasn't able to actually perform the transaction, so they needed to go outside and have this individual purchase the property in his own name. What does he do from there? Well, he doesn't keep it in his own name because he wants the protection, the veil. So he transfers it in name only to his company, Celebrate Properties, again, in the findings of fact, conclusions of law. From there, he cannot transfer the mortgage obligation because it's in his name and the bank will not finance Celebrate Properties. So it remains in Celebrate Properties' name, but the mortgage is in his own personal individual capacity. He admitted this on the stand. When he was asked later on the stand, did you inform the bank that you had made this transaction that really was in the name of the corporation, this limited liability corporation? However, you are the only one listed in the mortgage. Did you ever tell the bank that you had made that transfer? He said, no, I did not inform the bank of that transaction. Again, in the findings of fact and conclusions of law. Other things he did, and I mentioned and specifically referenced in my brief, that he made a lot of different transactions between his different companies. He admitted that on the stand, and again in the findings of fact and conclusions of law, he had at least 70 different, what he called these single transaction companies. What he did from there was transfer money in and out of all his different corporations, all his different companies, again, in the findings of fact, conclusions of law, as well as the exhibits and evidence. There's even a transaction, I can show you on one of the balance sheets, where one of the transactions was from him personally. He was listed personally in his individual name on Celebrate Properties' financial statements. That's, again, going to the issue of commingling of funds. What is the real danger in that? Is that what he's doing is setting up all these different companies so that if one looks like it may get tagged with some litigation or some potential liability, well, let's shift the assets out. Let's get them out. Put them in his own name if he needs to, and at the same time, remain with the protection of the corporation. And just so I can clarify it for your honors, if you look at, it's going to be Appellant's Appendix, page 143. Under cash and equivalents, you can see due to, from, and then a list of different companies, all of them he admitted at trial, and again, which were admitted into evidence at trial, that these were his different companies, and he was transferring funds in and out. If that's balance sheet for December 2003, there was about almost $800,000 he was transferring in and out of his different companies, in and out of Celebrate Properties. When you come to December 31st, 2004, which is Appellant's Appendix 0145, you look about quarter way down, you'll see due to from Harry Schull. That's him personally. He's transferring money in and out of this company. Again, with the different entities and himself individually, he's showing that he's commingling these funds and at the same time conducting business under the Celebrate Properties veil. Now again, why do I bring this up? It's very important because it shows that he has the ability then to never get sued. There's no incentive from him at that point in time to ever want to disclose defects. Because if for any reason he gets sued, well, let's throw the money. I've already been doing it. Let's throw the money into one of my 70 different companies, get sued, hide under the corporate veil, and be fine. Well, in this case, when you're dealing with that type of commingling where the mortgages are being taken out of his name when the company can't do it on its own, when he's financing it with $1 or $100, I apologize, it's $100. And that, again, findings of facts and conclusions of law, when you're doing that and then doing these types of transfers, including transferring money into your own name and then ceasing operations shortly after you sell a property where you know you've disclosed or you failed to disclose a known defect, that, Your Honor, all in the findings of fact and conclusions of law substantiate we should be allowed to pierce the corporate veil and go after him individually. If he's allowed to play those types of games with his company, they should be responsible for the activities of it when it commits wrong, and particularly in this case, a wrong that the Nevada state legislature said, we need to prevent this type of activity. We can't allow homeowners to sell their residences with known defects and dupe homeowners when we know that this is most homeowners' most substantial investment in their lives.
Counsel, you're at 146. You have not touched the other portion which you wish to go into, and you've not reserved any time.
I'm sorry?
I said you had 144 of your argument time. You've not touched the treble damages, which you indicated you were going to talk about, nor have you reserved time for any rebuttal. What is your pleasure at this time?
I will address it, Your Honor, but however, I believe I reserved 3 minutes.
Well, you don't. If you use up your time, we don't give you an additional three.
It's not jeopardy,
sir.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. In relation to the issue of the treble damages, I think the most telling thing is, and what this court should look to, is that this issue was never raised before the trial court. This issue was never brought in a motion during the trial. When we filed the findings of fact, conclusions of law, yes, my office prepared it, but that, under the rules, does not disallow the other party from objecting to it filing a motion to amend or alter or anything of that nature. All these things were at their disposal. They chose not to do it. There was no motion in limine. There was no motion for summary judgment. There was no objection even during closing argument that they can point to. That's in this record, and I've been tested on the record here today. There's nothing in this record where they've asked for that. That is a clear waiver of that argument. It's raised for the first time on appeal, Your Honor. And this is evident, of course, in the findings of fact and conclusions of law. Because in the findings of fact and conclusions of law, we don't necessarily know what standard the judge was raising. She found in favor of us on those causes of action. Did she find it wanton and willful? Well, it wasn't put to her that that was a necessary element. What was put to her was, did they violate that? And the standard that she used is, we don't know at this point in time. Why? Because it wasn't raised. So at this point in time, I don't believe this court should even entertain that argument. However, if the court does, under NRS 113.150, the language of the statute states unequivocally that the purchaser, if you're able to prove this up, that there was a failure to disclose a known defect, which we did, and the evidence and the record is clear, or very strong that he knew this defect existed and did not disclose it during the purchase, the statute reads, the purchaser is entitled to recover from the seller treble the amount necessary to repair or replace a defective part of the property. Is entitled. That's the statutory language directly from the legislature.
Do you have a concluding statement for us at this time?
And in conclusion, at this point in time, entitled under Black's Law definition is to grant a legal right to, which means at this point in time, the legislature has stated that if you're able to prove this, the plaintiff is entitled to treble damages, just like they said, and reasonable fees and costs. We don't see them asking for a different standard for fees and costs. This is what the legislature did. They knew that there are issues of relation to burden, and they chose not to put any different burden for this type of a civil matter. It's a civil case. There were other ways they could have gone about doing it, and they didn't. And again, I have 3 minutes, Your Honor, and I look forward
Counsel,
to it.
You've used up all your time, unless one of my colleagues wishes to extend more time. Any additional questions at this time?
I would like to note one thing, that I was prepared to address other cases from around the country where this issue of treble damages, including out of the United States Supreme Court, decided that if I'm not going to get any more time, Your Honor, the United States
Counsel, Supreme Court. Counsel, if it was in your brief, well, we reviewed that and we would take note of it. If it was not, it's not properly before the court at this time.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Good morning. I see it's 11 o'clock already, so I'll try to do it in 1 minute.
Counsel, you have your time. Please go ahead and make your arguments.
Sure.
Why don't you begin by pointing out where in the district court you preserved the subject that you raise on cross appeal?
What is that, sir? What's you mean the treble damages?
Yeah.
We never reserved it in the trial court because it never came in as any kind of an issue.
Excuse me?
It never came
they
in
sought,
as
an They sought treble damages in the trial court, did yeah, they not?
Yeah, however, we
and
didn't
in
think
in response
any...
to their request for treble damages, did you say to the district court judge, you can't award treble damages here in the absence of willful misconduct, some of the issues that you've raised in your cross appeal?
Yes, Your Honor, we did indicate that there was no intentional misconduct here, that if at most there was negligence, and the court bought that argument very well, as a matter of fact, there was no intent of any kind here. I tried the first 2 days of this case. There was another half day that I was absent due to a federal matter. My associate tried the last several hours of the case, so I wasn't there at the closing argument, but all the way through the case, we believe there was no intentional misconduct and made that point very clear in the testimony that was presented.
You know, I guess I find it a little personally disturbing that here you've got a residence that has soil issues. the builder obviously recognized that problem and that issue, and to avoid litigation, purchased the home back, and then that same individual sold that residence with no remediation whatsoever. I find it disturbing.
That's not accurate. This, first of all, this house was part of a project sold by one of the early Selby properties. I was the attorney for that company for a number of years. We formed over 60 LLCs. It's not a corporation, it's an LLC. We formed over 60 of them. Every time there was a new project, they formed an LLC to run that project. This house was part of a project in the early time of that company's existence, or of that group's existence. And the house was sold originally as part of a development. And a gentleman by the name of Robertson bought that house, and he claimed soils problems. We disputed that, and we eventually settled.
You're making this point. Is that part of the record? We understand there was a dispute. It was bought back, purchased by the LLC, Mr. Scholl specifically. He then transferred over to the company. Is this what you're telling us now? Is that part of the record?
No. Yes. Well, it's not part of the record, no. Not part of the findings of fact. But what is part of the findings of fact is that this house was originally completed in 2004, and it wasn't purchased until 2007 by this individual, who purchased it after a prior purchaser had complained of a soils problem. And Mr.
And your client was aware of that complaint. Is that not correct?
Yes, aware of the complaint. However, the complaint
did he investigate the complaint?
Pardon?
Are you aware of whether or not it was investigated?
Yes, I went there personally and investigated along with soils experts. And as a result of that, Mr. Scholl and his associate, Mr. Rosenberg, decided to purchase that property instead of going through a trial and litigation expenses, and they bought the property back from the former owner because they didn't believe there were any soils problems. Now, he alleged soils problems as part of the construction defect cottage industry that had developed here in Southern Nevada, but Mr. Scholl never believed there were soils problems.
Counsel, I would ask you to be very careful in your verbiage when you talk about this cottage industry.
Okay.
Having had the opportunity as a trial judge to sit on one of the largest soil defects in the county, over 140 homes, it is not just a hobgoblin, so to speak. It was real in some cases. I don't know about this specific case. I'll reserve my judgment. But I know the transaction that's been put forth in this record, so I'm having to take that at face value, unless you're telling me what you're asserting now was actually in the record before the court. If it's not, it's not germane to us.
What it was, and in the findings of fact, as you will see, that Mr. Webb didn't purchase the house till something like 3 or 4 years after the original purchaser had it. And that's in the record. What I wanted to point out, because I don't want to repeat what's in our briefs. I think our briefing is fairly detailed. What I want to point out was what Justice Hardesty had initially mentioned. In the findings of fact, the last finding of fact simply says, the plaintiff has failed to prove the defendant Harry Scholl is an alter ego of defendant Celebrate Properties LLC and accordingly dismisses all claims against Mr. Scholl personally. That's finding fact. And conclusion. Now, Mr. Cisneros, in his reply brief, says, in argument, standard of review, when the appellate record is limited to the trial court's findings, such findings must be accepted. He's telling the court what everybody already knows, but when I'm simply emphasizing the fact that the trial court made its findings, drew its conclusions, and what Mr. Cisneros is trying to do is to retry the alter ego issue in this case, which was part of the record below. And in order to do so, he has had to point to various items which, or he has, he's pointed to various items which are really inconclusive, such as a $100 bank deposit, when in fact the record shows that this company, this LLC, not a corporation, LLC, had $250,000 plus in its bank account as net worth at the first year of its existence, and continued to have, and the record shows, he supplied the record, that it had a net worth all the way through the period up until 2009 when it ceased doing business. And so his statements are simply trying to expand upon the findings and by innuendo indicate that there were some identity of interest and so on. And as he has cited, piercing the corporate veil, I suppose there's piercing a limited liability veil as well, that the corporation's influence and governed by the stockholder director officer. Well, there were two managers of this LLC. So Mr. Schell was not the only manager. He was originally the manager and became a corporate representative as a manager. The corporation was technically the manager of the LLC, as was another corporation, which Mr. Rosenberg, his associate, had at that time. So there were two managers here. It goes on in the law that a unity of interest has to exist between the corporation and the stockholder or director or officer, and they're inseparable. Well, as he points out, there were 70-some LLCs. Each time that they formed an LLC, they each had, other partners, we don't know, there's nothing in the findings to show that. But there were other managers, there may have been other managers, but there were at least two in this case. There was no unity of interest here particularly.
Well, and let me ask this question of you. The case is, as I understand Mr. Cisneros' argument in his briefs and again today, his point is that, I think I have this correct, that on page 5 of the conclusions of law, where the judge rejects the notion that they proved that Schell was an alter ego of Celebrate Properties, the conclusion of law is conclusory, that there is no analysis in the court's conclusions that would be expected to be made under NRS 78.747,
right,
where one, in effect, in looking at each element associated with an alter ego claim, compares or addresses the findings of fact the court has made,
correct,
with the elements set forth in the statute. By way of example, subsection 2A, the corporation is influenced or governed by the stockholder, director, or officer. The court reaches a general conclusion that they didn't prove it, but there's no analysis of that particular element in the context of the findings that the court did make.
Right.
Did the court commit error in not addressing each of those elements in arriving at its conclusion?
Well, I can't, of course, get into Judge Adair's mind.
Mm-hmm.
But she's pretty bright, through the trial, she evidenced how bright she was.
Well,
so I don't know.
This isn't a case about how the judge is. It's a case about whether a district court judge, in making an assessment of an alter ego claim, should be expected to address the components of the elements in their conclusions of law.
I would think so. Mr. Cisneros drafted the findings of fact.
Sure.
And there was no, and I.
Well, I suspect neither one of you really knew what the basis for her decision was, because she didn't articulate it beyond the conclusion,
right,
that they had failed to prove it.
Right.
But I guess what he's saying on appeal is that the judge should be expected to articulate those reasons in their conclusions.
Well, then why didn't he articulate it in the findings of fact? He's the one who drafted them. She adopted his findings of fact in hyc verba.
You read the findings of fact, you can see that there are some here that could be interpreted one way or the other. So what was it about the case that caused her to reject and fine for your client as opposed to his?
Well, I think my belief is that the third element of an alter ego, which is basically conduct which would maintain what I remember from law school a couple of weeks ago, was that there had to be a misuser. I think that was a term that my old professor used. There had to be a misuser of the corporate entity, because we didn't have LLCs when I went to law school.
Well, let's just stick with the statutory language. I know what you're trying to. I think I know what you're trying to articulate. Adherence to the corporate fiction of a separate entity would sanction a fraud or promote or manifest an injustice.
Right.
The findings of fact would imply that Mr. Scholl acquired the home from Mr. Robertson because the corporation could not do so, then transferred the home to the corporation. Why doesn't that act sanction or promote a manifest injustice or a fraud?
Because it doesn't rise to the level of a fraud. It, in this case, it was a matter of getting it done. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Scholl was capable of doing it. And I guess at the time, I have to guess, I have to infer, just like the court would have to, as to why that was done. Mm-hmm. But this LLC had a lot of money. It had produced a lot of homes. It shows in the balance sheet that they had lots of money. So, but maybe they getting a loan from some creditor, credit company was difficult at the time. I don't know. That's something to be inferred.
It
didn't rise to the level of fraud. I mean, she found negligence.
It is a concern that the house was purchased by the LLC for $1. When you talk about adequacy of financing and such, and makes one wonder if there was not fraud.
Well, the dollar was simply a symbolic manner of transferring it to the company. There was no, I mean, the intention at all times was to have the company rebuy it, and I guess at the time, once again, we'd have to guess as to why the company didn't get the financing to buy it, so Mr. Scholl did it and gave it to the company, which was the intent. So I, in direct response to Justice Hartzey, I just think it's she found negligence. Negligence doesn't rise to that level of fraud, and we can't second guess the trial judge, as because the statute and the case law seems to indicate that and Mr. Cisneros has admitted that the findings of fact can't be changed because this is not a factual situation here. We don't have evidence here.
Justice Hardesty, Justice Perry, any additional questions?
No, thank you.
Thank you very much.
This matter will stand submitted. We thank counsel for their arguments this day. And we will go to our next case.